It's 4:30 a.m. and a Flagstaff police officer had just pulled me over. He walks towards the car.
"Good morning, sir,"
he says in his cop voice.
"Do you know why I pulled you over today?"
"No, sir. I really don't know why you pulled me over."
"You've been driving with your headlights off."
"I'm sorry, sir," I respond. "I thought they were on." He's not buying it and he shines his flashlight in my eyes. I recoil like any normal person would.
"Have you been drinking, sir?"
"No, sir. I've only been up for like 5 minutes.
"Where are you headed?"
"I'm headed to the Newman Center on campus. We're taking a group of students to the Grand Canyon for sunrise."
"You work there?" he asks.
"Kind of. I'm a missionary, so I guess I work there."
"Really? A missionary? What church?"
"Catholic," I respond. He looks at me confused. I'd be lying if I said this was the first time a law enforcement officer looked at me with that face when I said I was a Catholic missionary. It was a look of confusion and disbelief, coupled with amusement and a hint of doubt, as if this was the best, worst cover story they'd ever heard. His face shifts back to business.
"Are you planning on driving?"
"Not if I can help it." He gives me a long stare and sighs.
"Okay, I'll let you off with a warning."
"Thank you, officer."
"But do turn our lights on and drive safe. There's ice on the road."
I wait for him to drive off before driving off myself. This was not the auspicious start to my Grand Canyon adventure that I was hoping for, but it was enough to spook me out of wanting to drive. So I hopped into the backseat of one of our student leaders' cars, an 80s model BMW, solid steel body, and boxy like nobody's business. Trees flank us like sentinels lining both sides of the road as we drive north through the ponderosa pine forest. The night sky is cold and clear. You can practically see the Milky Way. It's still early and the sky is still dark, and we whisper about keeping our eyes open for elk. If hitting a deer is bad, hitting an elk would be devastating. It's practically as big as a car. So we're diligent in our watch, scanning the horizon and tree line for movement, looking for giant silhouettes in the distance when we hit a patch of black ice that sends the rear of our car sliding out from behind us. The back tire catches the rough gravel on the side of the road and that pitches the car into the air as we roll over. In the air, everything seems to slow down around us. The music slows. Our breathing slows. The flipping of the car slows. At my window, I can see the ground give way to the trees, which then gives way to open sky. I can see stars, hundreds of them, thousands of them, more than I've ever noticed before, and still there are more than I can even comprehend. Like millions of eyes staring back at me, watching over me. In this moment, I don't feel scared. I don't feel much of anything. Just a sense of stillness, timelessness, eternity. Then the sky gives way to the trees, and those trees give way to the ground as we complete our rotation.
"Are you okay?"
Our driver's voice pierces the silence. "We're okay." Somewhere in that last flip, my eyes close and have remained closed. I take a deep breath, open my eyes. I'm upside down, hanging from my seatbelt, staring at a tree trunk not 6 inches from my face outside the window. I unclick my seatbelt and climb out of the car and look back at the damage. The car is upside down, leaning against a tree, a sizable dent in its metal roof. It's honestly not as bad as you'd think it'd be, though. This car accident was not a life-changing moment. In fact, it felt almost ordinary. I didn't walk away with a newfound appreciation for life, with anxiety tied to driving. That morning's sunrise was particularly beautiful, though. But that probably had more to do with it being my first sunrise at the Grand Canyon than it did with me being in a car accident. These days, when I'm feeling particularly stressed or overwhelmed or lonely, I get a flash of an image of the stars through that car window with the world spinning around me, and that odd sense of comfort I felt, and I'm reminded of the prayers of my mother, my suegra, my wife, my family and my friends. And then I think of my grandma Licha and my tío JR and Nuno, who have all passed, who I know are still praying for me. Then I think of the saints, those who I already know, and those who I won't know until I get into heaven. Hundreds of them, thousands of them, more than I've ever noticed before, and still there are more than I can comprehend. And I know they are praying for me, just like they're praying for you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Protagonists of Change. I'm your host, Darnell Miller, and today we're talking about saints, men and women who lived ordinary and extraordinary lives filled with heroic virtue. We're talking to Meg Hunter-Kilmer, an itinerant missionary who travels the world living out of her car, talking about her love for Christ. She's also written the book on saints, two of them actually, and loves to connect people to those in heaven who are already praying for them. She tells us about her life as a missionary and how she came to know and love the saints that she does. Then, in Who's That Saint, we're doing something a little bit different. We let Meg tell the story of a saint whose story has been pulling on her heart, Venerable Alphonse Gallegos. Now let's get into this episode with Meg.
I was a sophomore in high school, and we had this big project in high school where you had to do a persona project, like a biography of somebody who was important in the Renaissance world. And I had only just met Jesus. I was a cradle Catholic, but I met Jesus in eighth grade. And I was like, well, there were probably Catholics who were important in the Renaissance world, right? Like maybe, I don't know, maybe even like saints who were important. Like I didn't know anything. And I was like doing some searching, and I was like, oh, this guy, Francis Xavier, like, he preached the gospel in India. He preached the gospel in Japan. He seems like he was probably fairly significant on a world history stage. And so I started to study him and just getting excited about the concept of missionary life. It wasn't so much a relationship with him as like, oh yeah, like I could be a missionary. Like that's a thing that I could do, and I could go around and I could tell people about how much God loves them, and I could bring this joy of knowing the love of Jesus into their lives that has transformed my life so much.
St. Francis Xavier was the first saint that was even remotely interesting to Meg as she was growing up. He offered her a new perspective, a new path to holiness that, even though she would not pursue it immediately, would come back and change the course of her life. But who was St. Francis Xavier?
He's fantastic. He's my patron of randomly assigned college roommates. He was going to be a priest, and he was probably going to be a decent human being, and he got this randomly assigned like whack job of a roommate, this nut who was in his 40s, right? So Xavier's like early 20s, and he gets this 40-year-old roommate who's like wandering around barefoot all the time and giving away everything he owns and won't stop talking about Jesus. And Xavier's like, bro, look, we are all Catholic here, okay? Like it's France in the 16th century, but you don't have to be weird about it. And his roommate was just like super weird about it, but weird in this incredibly compelling way. And ultimately, it made saints of all three of them. So their third roommate was Saint Peter Faber, and the weirdo was Saint Ignatius Loyola. And the three of them, because of being randomly assigned college roommates, are now canonized saints and the founders of the Jesuit order, right? And so just, you know, recognizing the way that God is at work, like Francis Xavier, without that relationship with Ignatius Loyola, would have lived and died a nobody. You know, like he would have been a successful academic, and he might have accomplished some good things, and there's no world in which he becomes a saint. There's no world in which he becomes a missionary who changed the fate of literally the entire planet. He baptized 300,000 people with his own two hands, right? Like, this guy is incredible, and it's because of this communion of saints already at work in the world.
Just like Proverbs 27 says, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. So saints make saints of each other. But growing up, Meg didn't get the saints. Like, she understood that there were holy people, but she felt that no saint spoke to her.
Every saint story you ever heard is like, she was very holy and she never sinned. And you're like, okay. Or like, he bathed in the blood of 1,000 enemies every day. And then he had a conversion and he never sinned again. And you're like, okay, like, good for you. That's not my story. And I just feel like every story that I heard was so irrelevant. They were all just so two-dimensional and very much glorifying a personality that is not mine and that could never be mine. And so every story that I ever heard was like, okay, well, I just don't fit, right? Like I have to shrink, I have to smash myself into this model of holiness, which isn't the model that the church puts forward for us, right? It's very much at the time, a 20th century American image of holiness that involved being purely placid and pleasant, and that's just not the person that I am. And it was, I mean, Teresa of Avila, I heard the story of Teresa of Avila, and I was like, well, she sounds like she was a lot. you know, so like maybe there's hope for me, right? Maybe there's space for a female saint who's a lot. But by and large, the way that I was hearing the stories told, it wasn't anything that brought any hope to my life. And so I just kind of was like, okay, well, for some unexplainable reason, some people are into this and it's just not my thing. And so I kind of ignored the saints for the first 15 years that I loved Jesus, till I was probably coming up on 30.
Meg didn't see herself in the stories of the saints as they were being told. What did that mean, and how could she tell those stories differently?
So I finally heard the stories told well. There's a hagiographer named Anne Ball, who is now deceased, but she wrote a couple of books called Modern Saints in the early 80s. And I stumbled across these books when I was probably about 30. And I read these stories, and for the first time I was like, oh wait, these stories aren't boring, right? They're not boring, and they're not two-dimensional, and they're not people whose lives can't be imitated. And if we tell the stories right, then they're about Jesus. See, I feel like not only was every story I heard just a list of facts with no narrative thrust, it also wasn't about Jesus. It was, here are some cool things St. Francis did with bunnies, and no exploration of his encounter with the God who loved him so fiercely. And all, even the best told stories, they're only ever pointing to the person, which is exactly the opposite of what a saint is supposed to be. And her stories, they were captivating. They were personal. They were intimate snapshots of personalities in these lives. And they were always pointing people back to Jesus. And I read this book and I was like, oh, this could really be something. And I've always been a storyteller. I just never really had any worthwhile stories to tell. You know, it's just that like typical Catholic speaker thing where you're just going to stand up and like tell some story about your life that's funny and everybody's laughing. And then you're like, and here's a connection, you know, but it was only ever telling the story because I need to tell a story and not because you need to hear this story. You know, I mean, with some exception, right? Sometimes it was like, here's a cool thing that God did in my life. But I heard the stories of the saints and I was like, this is what I was made for, right? Like God made me a storyteller and I've just been telling worthless stories my entire life. And now here are these stories that I can tell that begin to break down the walls that we've built around ourselves, that begin to speak to people who have any number of reasons that they feel that they're ineligible for the love of God, that they don't belong in the church. And to be able to say to people like, look, I know you don't see people who look like you in your church in suburban Missouri. Like, I know that, but there are hundreds of saints of Asian descent, right? There are all of these saints who have disabilities. There are all of these saints whose parents were divorced. There are all of these saints with mental illness, you know, all of these things that make us feel like we don't belong, that make us feel alone. It's not just like there are other Catholics like this, but like maybe they put a halo on that. You know, like this is what your struggle or your passion or your culture or your family looks like when it's shot through with glory. You are not an accident. You are not a mistake. And encountering the saints in that way and recognizing the way that the saints make evangelization so possible because they put a name on the parts of our lives that we think are ineligible for God's love. And they say, no, see, this is the way that God is going to use you to draw people to him.
So charged with a new mission, with stories worth telling, Meg quit her job as a teacher and began traveling the country, living out of her car and telling stories of the saints and of God's love.
We have so many different kinds of saints, and we just stick with the old 15 that we know. You know, we got Francis and Anthony and Therese and Padre Pio, and they're great. They're great, but we're even in telling those stories, we're not sharing the reality, right? Like everybody wants to talk about St. Therese and nobody wants to talk about her borderline despair when she was dealing with suicidal ideations because that's part of end-stage tuberculosis, right? And people are like, no, Bo, but Therese was so sweet. And you're like, she was. She was also real salty and she was also like really, really suffering. And that's what makes her beautiful. And people just, we want to whitewash out the struggle. And in looking for that struggle, I just found so many friends who could sit with me in my suffering. You know, and a big thing for me is showcasing all of the different types of saints that we have. So I do a lot of work on ethnic and racial representation in the saints, because we have so many saints from all over the world and they just get no press at all. And I'm like, here's the thing, like the number of Asian Americans I've talked to who are like, I did not know there were saints who looked like me. And I'm like, well, there are 103 Korean Catholic saints and 124 Korean Catholic blesseds and 120 Chinese Catholic saints and 188 Japanese Catholic blesseds and 117 Vietnamese Catholic saints. Like, I could keep going. They're there. We haven't focused our attention on telling those stories.
So let's take a look at some of these saints.
And so I started to dig into those stories and to discover just these incredible, incredible people. Blessed Columba Kangwon-suk, whose husband divorced her because of her relationship with Jesus. And she's, you know, obviously not thrilled by this, or it doesn't sound like he was the world's best guy, but ideally he would also be converted and become an incredible husband. And that's not what happened. He left her for a concubine. And she's sitting there like, what do I even do with this, Lord? Like, I'm trying to be faithful to you. I'm trying to follow you. And like, this is what I'm dealing with now. And then she realizes that in 18th century Korea, it was illegal for the police to search the home of a noblewoman if her husband didn't live with her. And so because her husband left, her house was basically no man's land, right? Like, the police couldn't come in. And so it's illegal to be a Catholic, but not at Columba's house. She becomes the heart of the Catholic Church in Korea. She's the one who's in charge of the one priest that they have when he gets smuggled in from China, right? Because Korea is just incredible. In the first 50 years there were Catholics in Korea, there was one priest for 6 years total, and he was an undocumented immigrant from China, right? So they're just like killing it, and it's because of Columba, and it's because her husband left. And so to sit with her when you're experiencing an unanswered prayer, and when you're looking at a part of your life where you're just like, Lord, I know you could have fixed this for me and you didn't, to be able to say like, I don't have to say that this is good, but I can trust that God is working. Right? And Columba sitting next to you and being like, look, my divorce was not awesome, but God was faithful in the midst of that. And souls were saved because of that. Lives were saved because of that. You know, like, you can trust that God is with you even in the midst of the struggle. And to have those kinds of friends to surround you. And these are people that I never would have met, except that I was like, well, hang on. Like, what's going on in Korea? Because there's a lot of saints over there, you know? Like, let me dig into this. And learning about St. Agatha Kimagi, who was intellectually disabled, and learning about St. Columba Kim Hyo Im and Agnes Kim Hyo Ju, who were survivors of sexual assault, and Columba, who brought charges against their assailants, and Agnes, who wasn't able to, right? And just looking at these women who can stand beside you if you've had an experience of sexual assault, who can stand beside you and hold you when you are trying to have the strength to bring charges, and hold you when you just know that you can't. Just what a gift to be surrounded by these saints who've had these experiences, who know what it's like to suffer in the way that we suffer and to struggle in the way that we struggle.
This idea of someone to stand beside you during trying times is not how most of us view the saints working in our lives. We often put them on a pedestal to be honored and exemplified. But for Meg, they are that, yes, but they are also companions, confidants, and friends with whom she shares her life.
I mean, it's been such a gift to come to know the saints, not just as stories, but as friends. And there are a lot of saints where I know their story, and I'm excited to share the story, and we're not friends, and that's okay, right? Like, we're acquaintances, and that's cool. We're friendly, but they're not like the ones who sit with me when I'm suffering. And then there are others who, you know, maybe I encountered because I was doing research into a particular kind of saint, or maybe I encountered because I was on a pilgrimage and I just sort of ran across this person and was like, oh my gosh, I think we should be friends. Saint Barnabas is my best friend, really, because I had a spiritual director who was like, well, you're like a Saint Paul, and who's your Saint Barnabas? And he meant like my actual real life Saint Barnabas. And Saint Barnabas was like, it's me, I'm your Saint Barnabas, you know? Like, and he's just been my buddy for so long because of that. But it's been beautiful to see the way that the saints sort of step in different phases of my life, different seasons. You know, I mentioned Blessed Peter Kasui Kibe, who walked 3,700 miles so that he could get ordained, which was not even like the entirety of his journey. It took him 24 years from when he first tried to be a priest until he finally made it back to Japan as a Jesuit priest, with like shipwreck and pirates and just all kinds of nonsense. And there was a season in my life where I would like I just wanted to spend my life having a pity party. And he was like, I'm gonna need you to suck it up, right? Like, I walked 3,700 miles and I'm gonna need you to suck it up. And that was such an important thing for me to have during that season. And we're still definitely friends, but I feel like right now I need a little bit more of the St. Leopold Mandić, who's like, yeah, you know what? Sometimes your prayers just go unanswered for your entire life and then you die. And God is still good. You know, like, hearing these saints where like they prayed and prayed and prayed and then they got what they want, I'm like, that's great for you, but that's actually not really helpful to me, because it compels me then to root my hope in the answer to prayers instead of in the one who answers prayers. And Leopold Mandić, who lived a profoundly unsatisfied life where God didn't answer the one thing that he wanted his entire life, he sits there and he's like, yeah, no, it's not okay. And God is still good. It's not fair. And you are not alone. And you are not unloved. And so to have these saints, sometimes just as like a witness to stand next to me and be like, no, you can be a loud and intense and emotional woman, and that can be the way that God is using you to do great work in the world. And sometimes it's saints who are like, yeah, you can be brilliant and be a Christian. And other times it's saints who sit there and are like, you can be just really broken. And that's a beautiful thing too. And so to have those saints accompanying me is an enormous gift. But then, golly, I'm just so grateful for the way that I get to introduce other people to the saints. And for the number of times that I tell a story and I just see people's eyes light up, or I see them break. And sometimes I like know what I'm doing, you know, like they're kind of telling me what they're going through and I'm like, well, I got a saint for you. And I tell the story and I see the connection, but it's like a connection that I knew was coming, you know? And then I can kind of be like, I am really good at this, right? Like, I'm super good at my job. I'm like an encyclopedia over here. And other times they're talking and I'm like, I don't know why, but I just want to tell you this story. And I tell them the story of a saint and they break down. And sometimes they're like, yeah, you know, I didn't tell you this, this, and this, but here's the connection. And sometimes they're like, I don't know. I just love him. And I don't know why. And that's my favorite, because that's when I'm like, well, this is not look at Meg doing her little saint magic. This is just, this saint has loved you since before you were born. For no particular reason. Like, sometimes people are just fond of each other and there's no real connection. And you were never gonna know her name. But the Holy Spirit was moving and I was able to get out of the way. And you now have this friendship that's gonna last you through to the end of eternity. And it's just, it's something that the Lord was able to accomplish because I am weird and overly excited and never shut up. You know, and like, God made me on purpose and he loves that I am weird and overly excited and never shut up. And like, he's using that for good. So yeah. And then I think the other big thing is just the number of people who have these blocks in place where they're like, God can't love me, or I don't belong. You know, the devil just, he speaks loudly in people's hearts. People who are dealing with mental illness who are like, well, if I were really faithful. I'm like, no, if I were really faithful. Blessed Basil Hopko had depression so bad that the communist prison guards let him out of his communist prison camp so that he could go get treatment. Like, you gotta be really far gone for communist prison guards to let you out, right? That is not how this works. And so for people to hear that and they're like, wait, but like then he had his conversion. I'm like, no, he was a bishop. That's what holiness looked like for him. It looks like depression. And Blessed Rutilio Grande had catatonic schizophrenia, and St. Oscar Romero had diagnosed OCD, and Servant of God Rose Hawthorne Lathrop was hospitalized for postpartum depression. Like, God is with you in this. He's with you in every moment of it. And to say that with abuse and with brokenness in the family, and even with things like, look, I know that you love surfing. Like, I know that you love surfing. That is awesome that you love surfing. Servant of God Guido Schaefer was a surfer. He was a surfer and a doctor and a seminarian. Here are some photographs of him. It's like 2007, right? Like sport quality photographs of him on a surfboard, and the dude's gonna be a saint. Like, God is there and he's at work.
So how does this friendship with saints work? much like that of IRL friendships, based on mutual respect, interest, and sometimes for no real rhyme and reason. But that also means that you may not jive with every saint.
Well, Saint Barnabas loves me. Like, he's obsessed with me, and he might not be that into you, you know? Like, but there are saints where I'm gonna get to heaven, and they're gonna be like, oh my gosh, hey Meg, and you're gonna get to heaven and be like, what? Are you kidding me right now? Like, you are here. Just the particularity of friendship, I think, is a really beautiful thing. And you can have saints where you're like, I don't really get it. Like, I don't really get what the church sees in Rose of Lima and Saint Ludwina, or, you know, like these saints where, like, maybe the stories are told in sort of a toxic way, right? And that doesn't mean, like, you can't be friends with that person. It's just like, we're gonna need to chat. Like, when we meet, I'm gonna figure out what your deal actually is, like, without the 17th century lens that's put on it. But there are other saints where you'd be like, no, I totally get it. Like, I get the story and I've heard it and it makes a lot of sense. And, like, it's cool. And, like, we just don't click, and that's fine. You don't have to click with everybody. And sometimes, I don't know, the number of people who will tell me, I just love this saint because I love him. And I'm like, yes, awesome. Like, that's great, because it means that you have a friendship, and that's how friendship is, right? Friendship sometimes is like, I love this person because they're like this and they do this and they tell these jokes. And sometimes it's like, I don't know, we just love each other. And, like, that's just all there is to it. And I think we forget that the saints are people, and that it's okay to have a particular love for certain people.
It's okay to have a particular love for certain people. And for Meg, that means Saint Barnabas. But who is Saint Barnabas, and how is he tied into her life?
So Saint Barnabas was Saint Paul's best friend, and I am a lot like Saint Paul. We have the same life. We have the same personality. I also sometimes think that you should write you stupid Galatians to people. And Barnabas put up with Paul, which is, you know, a pretty good sign that he's going to put up with me. But he was just, he was so good. His name means son of encouragement. Like, he was so kind and so gentle and so sensitive that they were like, we got to give this guy a name that means, man, he's just so good, right? And he was the one, when Paul had his conversion and was like, hey, y'all, I'm Christian now. They were like, you are obviously not. We are not stupid. You were going to murder us all. Barnabas was the one who was like, no, like, it is possible for God to change people. And I don't know, maybe Peter didn't remember who he used to be, and maybe Matthew didn't remember who he used to be, but Barnabas remembered. And Barnabas was like, I trust that God can do this. And I'm sure that his buddies were like, but do you trust that he did do this with that guy? And he's like, I'm willing to die to find out. You know, like, that degree of reckless love. And then, I mean, you really just see Barnabas being a sidekick to Paul. And eventually, they had a falling out because Barnabas's cousin Mark, who wrote the Gospel of Mark, had abandoned them earlier, and then he came back. And Barnabas was like, welcome back. And Paul was like, I don't trust you. I don't trust you. You screwed up and you're done, right? Like, Paul was like that, despite the fact that he had been forgiven so much. And Barnabas was like, see, Paul, I don't quit on people. And if Mark says that he's sorry, and if he says he's going to be faithful, then I'm in. And Paul couldn't handle it. And it ended up being the end of their work together. But again, it was this reckless love where Barnabas was like, we've done so much good work. There's been so much fruit. I love this man with everything that I am. But I'm a person who loves recklessly. And Mark is the one who's in need of that love right now. And eventually Paul and Mark were reconciled. And so we trust that Paul and Barnabas were reconciled, certainly in heaven, if not on earth. But seeing Barnabas, and partially for me, it's to have him as a friend who stands beside me and who loves me recklessly and who sees through all of the mess that I sort of put between myself and the world. And it's like, yeah, I know who you really are. And partially, it's that I want to love recklessly like that. I want to take risks, and I want to seek out the marginalized. And I want to say, look, if this gets me canceled, if this gets me excommunicated, I don't see how that happens, right? But, like, you know, if loving these marginalized people, if speaking the love of God in radical ways costs me a lot, and it has, it's worth it, right? I want to be the kind of person who could be called a daughter of encouragement. And it's interesting because, you know, there's a particular intention of mine that I've entrusted to Saint Barnabas, and he's like not not following through, like not hooking me up one bit. And so, but there's something beautiful that I'm like, look, you're in charge of this and you're bad at it. And that's okay, because this is not a transactional relationship, right? Like, I'm not friends with you so that you can get me favors from God. I'm friends with you because you love me. And because I am a better person when I'm living in a way that's modeled on the love that you have for this world. I've been doing a lot on Venerable Alphonse Gallegos lately. So he is Mexican-American. He's the only Latino-American born in the continental U.S. with an open cause for canonization. He was fourth-generation Mexican-American. He was born in Albuquerque, grew up not speaking Spanish. So, like, really cool for people who are second, third generation immigrants who don't have that connection to their ancestral language, for whom that can be a real place of shame. Like, he ended up having to learn Spanish as an adult so he could serve his people, and sort of like stepping into that discomfort and saying, like, I'm not gonna blink at the people who look at me funny when I'm a brown man who can't speak Spanish, right? Because this is what my people need. And so, like, I'm gonna embrace this. But he grew up in LA City public schools. He had a severe visual disability. If you held up two fingers 10 inches in front of his face, he couldn't count. He had a surgery that helped some, but he was just this like very ordinary kid, right? Like living in Watts, which is across the street from Compton, not speaking Spanish, going to public school. And he ended up becoming a priest, and it was like a whole thing because he couldn't pray the office because he couldn't read. Certainly not at the pace that his community did. So he had to get a dispensation. So like seeing the accommodations at the church made the effort to provide, and recognizing that like they weren't doing him a favor, like he was doing them a favor by allowing them to do the justice of providing these accommodations. He gets ordained and he goes back to Watts, and he's just like walking the streets. He's working with gang members and he's like friends with everybody in town. And eventually he gets made auxiliary bishop up in Sacramento. And he was like tight with all the lowriders, right? Like I actually went to this like lowrider event and was like meeting these people, and they're like, oh yeah, I remember Bishop Gallegos. Yeah, he actually married me. And like telling the story of like, there was this couple, they wanted to get their babies baptized, but the priest wouldn't do it because they weren't married. And the bishop was like, you wanna get your babies baptized? I'll baptize your babies, I'll baptize them on Saturday. First, I'm gonna marry you. Saturday good? And like, just like does this marriage rep and like marries them and baptizes their babies. And he was so close with everybody in the community and everybody I talked to. And I'd be like, what was it like when he died? And they would just burst into tears. Like, can you imagine having a relationship with your auxiliary bishop that 30 years later you start crying because he died? There was this one woman, she was like, I didn't even know him that well, but like, he would come on the playground during recess and he would like hold your hand and walk around and like, he would turn the jump rope and like just the way that he loved people. I talked to one guy and he was like, I said to him, how would your life be different if you hadn't known Bishop Gallegos? He said, I'd be in prison or I would be dead. And like, they're telling me a story about a man who showed up on the avenue to shoot somebody who had gotten his little sister pregnant, and Bishop Gallegos walks up and like talks him down, takes the gun, sends him home. And he would sleep in the migrant camps for a week at a time, and he's protesting nuclear warfare, and he's like out there at anti-abortion protests. His bishop said he's the most faithful bishop to the magisterium I have ever known. But none of it was about issues. It was only ever about people. And I asked one guy, I was like, what would he call you? And he was like, what do you mean? I was like, was he like a mijo kind of a guy? And he was like, no, he called you by your name. Because he knew your name. And just looking at this witness, and at the last day of his life, he went and visited a man who was dying of AIDS in the hospital, which in 1991, that's a risk that you're taking at that point, at least in people's minds. And he went and made tamales with some of the little abuelas in one of his parishes, and he went with a Korean Catholic community to scout a church site, and then he went up to celebrate a confirmation. And he's on his way home, and he drove this janky old car. He didn't drive, he had a driver because he could not see. He's driving this janky old car because he was like, I don't need anything nice, like I'm just a bishop, it's fine. And his car broke down and he got out to push. And his driver was like, don't push. Like, I will push. And he was like, I can't see. I got to push, right? So he got hit by a car. At his funeral, 300 lowriders showed up in procession because they loved this man so much. And just thinking, like, as a person working in ministry, it's so easy for it to be about numbers, about programs, about quotas, about best practices. And like, Bishop Gallegos was like, no, I'm just gonna love people.
If you've made it this far, thank you for sticking with us. This whole project is a labor of love, but we want to hear from you. Which saint is your friend? Let us know. Hit us up on social media at MaxStudiosUST on Instagram and Facebook. Subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And hey, if this is something you enjoy, leave us a review. Also, share this with your friends, family, coworkers, classmates, that person who needs to know the saints are there for them. And thank you to Dr. Richard Ludwig, Jeff Olson, Kyle Hyman at Spoke Street Media for editing support, and Bridget Richardson, our executive producer. And a special thanks to Meg Hunter-Kilmer for taking the time to talk to us. You can learn more about her on Instagram at mhunterkilmer or on her website, www.pierstans.com. And also check out her books, Saints Around the World and Pray for Us, 75 Saints Who Sinned, Suffered, and Struggled on Their Way to Holiness. You've been listening to Protagonists of Change, a production of Max Studios at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. I'm Darnell Miller, and until next time, peace.